Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 4 of Dirty Sexy History. My name is Jessica Kale, and I have been busy over the break. We've got some great new interviews recorded and ready to go, with plenty more on the books for the rest of the year. Aside from that, I've been working on an exciting side project related to what we do here on the podcast, and things are going very well. I can't say anything more yet, but you can look forward to some hopefully less cryptic updates in the coming months. Now, this school year may be wrapping up, but history never sleeps, and neither do I. This podcast runs year-round, and we'll have plenty more great stories and interviews from some of the most exciting historians working today to fill up your summer vacation or your morning commute. We've got lots of medical history coming up, because I love it, more pirates, spiritualists, badass women, and so much more. This week, we are welcoming back to the show actress and historical fiction author Susan Wands to talk about two legendary ladies, Florence Farr and Ellen Terry, who appear in her new book, High Priestess and Empress. Now, the last time we spoke to Susan, we talked about the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and how Pamela Coleman Smith came to illustrate the iconic Rider-Waite-Smith tarot deck that so many of us know and love today. We are picking up right where we left off, talking about the remarkable lives of Florence Farr, who actually ran the Golden Dawn for a period of time and may have inspired the High Priestess card, and Ellen Terry, one of the most iconic and influential actresses in 19th and early 20th century England. Ellen herself may have inspired the Empress card. Now, this episode has lots of pictures, so if you're curious about the people that we mention, you can find those on our Instagram at Dirty Sexy History. Now, Susan is such a great guest, and I loved this conversation. I hope you enjoy it. All right, everybody. I am so glad to welcome back to the show Susan Wands. Susan's new book is High Priestess and Empress, book 2 in the Arcana Oracle series. Susan, welcome back.
Thank you, Jessica. I love listening to Dirty Sexy History, and I'm so thrilled to be on here for a second time.
Oh, we're so glad to have you back. I am loving these books. You know, you'd think that I'd read more historical fiction, and I don't, sadly, not because I don't love it, but just because I don't have time. But every time one of your books comes out, I've got to read it immediately. I just love your books. They're so fun. And it's such an interesting time period and subject matter. Of course, in the last episode that we had you on, we were talking about The Golden Dawn and Pamela Coleman Smith. And this book picks up where, of course, that one left off. Focusing on Florence Farr and Ellen Terry. So in the book, these are Pamela's muses for the High Priestess and the Empress. Did these women actually inspire those cards?
I believe that they did. Florence Farr was actually someone who had talked to Pamela in New York City about designing the set for William Butler Yeats's play, The Countess Kathleen. And she and Florence both attended the Golden Dawn training seminars, and sort of like level one. So they did work together. And Ellen Terry was a surrogate mother of sorts to Pamela in her earlier years in London. So they were actually people in Pamela's life. And I believe that they absolutely embodied those two tarot cards, certainly with the Empress card in terms of it being pregnant and being matronly and motherly. That was Ellen to Pamela. Florence was such a rebel in terms of philosophy and male dominance of ideas, of any kind of ideas that women would be going forward, that I think she's the ideal high priestess.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. And when I was looking at pictures of Ellen Terry, of course, I recognized her right away. I've seen pictures of her floating around for years, and she's so beautiful. And in that kind of empress way, isn't she? You know, I mean, I could really see it. There's this one picture of her in particular that I've been seeing going around the internet for a couple of years. And I'll post it on our Instagram, because I think you guys are going to recognize it. But it's so lovely. And it doesn't look like it's 100 years old. It looks like it could have been taken yesterday. You know, she has so much emotion, and the composition and everything looks very modern. Do you think it's safe to say that these ladies were ahead of their time?
Absolutely. They were breaking the molds in terms of being, you know, demure little Victorian ladies. They were expressive. They, you know, were sliding down banisters. They were riding bicycles. They were going to places unescorted. They were absolutely breaking the molds at the time about what women were entitled to do without the male gaze or as chaperones.
Yeah. And of course, so much that we know about them, or at least these kind of artistic depictions of them, they do kind of come through the male gaze, which of course we'll have to ask you about that as well. Now, I want to talk about both of these ladies. They're just so extraordinary. But let's go ahead and start with Florence. So, speaking of the male gaze, when Florence was 19, she modeled for Edward Burne-Jones's painting, The Golden Stair. Can you tell us a little bit about this painting?
This was an amazing painting because Edward was trying to create this very mystical setting of all these maidens coming down this staircase holding musical instruments. It went through a couple titles. It was called The King's Music or The Dawning of Something, but he couldn't quite settle on it. But the whole idea is that something ominous or ceremonial is happening off stage. And the person who has the center POV is Florence. And she's on the center staircase holding this small harp that she played. Now, the thing that was really fantastic was that this was when Florence was going to college, one of the first colleges. And this attire of women wearing like Grecian robes, with their breasts and possibly nipples being, seen was very controversial. And this sort of ensemble became a uniform of sorts for Florence as she went along. But this was really in the company of some of the major artists of the day because Morris May's daughter was in it, the politicians, Disraeli's daughter was in it, all these sort of up and coming young suffragists, artists were models. Of course, they wanted young maidens that looked virginal to be coming down these stairs. So, and even though it's called the King's Music, no one's playing a note. So you're going, so did the King's Music happen? Is it going to happen? But the idea was that these were muses, these were handmaidens to the king or to music, and they were the embodiment of everything that was lovely and seductive about a virginal handmaiden.
Yeah, and there's something so eerie about the picture. I don't know what it is. It's quite uncanny. It's very spooky. But when you look at it, it did actually make me think of the High Priestess card. There's something about it. I don't know. A little bit of foreshadowing there, maybe. But what's so interesting, of course, is you do notice those beautiful kind of Grecian gowns, and she continued to dress like this.
Absolutely. In fact, some of the reviews made fun of the outfits, calling it tin foil nightgowns. And of course, Florence took to wearing these when she was performing her original poetry and music with William Butler Yeats, who she met in the Golden Dawn. But there's an unusual monochromatic scale to the painting, is that there are not a lot of primary colors. And I think this was very much in tune with Florence's idea of being in a ritual and performing as an actress. So it was a great harbinger of her role when she was the leader of the Golden Dawn later.
Wow, I just love that. Now, of course, you mentioned that she was in college at the time, and Florence went to Queen's College London, which was one of the first institutions to award qualifications to women. So, what was Queen's College like at the time, and what was the experience like for Florence?
Well, it was very controversial because at the time that Florence was going, there was a young woman who was a principal at 27 years of age. And this principal was the first female principal in England. And so there was a new idea that women should be taught not only the basics, which were usually science, chemistry, English, but the arts. And so Florence was not only learning to perform music, but learning to express herself. Unfortunately, Florence was not fond of going to school under class time. She felt that the structure of, performative exams and performative knowledge was really against her instincts. And if it was one thing that Florence was becoming very much aware of, is that she wanted to lead her life by instinct, which at the time was just seen as, you're a wild woman, you're uncontrollable, how dare you? So in a way, she did graduate from college and become what was expected of her, a teacher. But then she realized teaching that this was not for her. She wanted to be a creator, an originator, and being a teacher for her was not her calling at that time.
That's right. So, although she had considered being a teacher, of course, she turned to acting after the death of her father. So, how did she get involved with the theater?
Oh, this was a great story. When she was living in Bedford Park in London, it was sort of like this hothouse of all these creators. And there was something called the Bedford Park Dramatics. And they picked Florence to be in this terrible play called A Sicilian Odyssey. And she played this moon goddess. And the first night that she went out in it, who was in the audience but George Bernard Shaw and William Butler Yeats. And of course, they both had mad crushes on her. Yes. She's wearing another one of her tinkly foil gown things. And she's got this beautiful sonorous voice, probably from cigarette smoking, but also from singing and staying out drinking. But this beautiful voice. And they both decide that she is going to be their muse. So there became a little bit of jockeying about, is she available? Is she free? Well, by that point, Florence had had a very unsuccessful love and sex life. And so she was on the market, but she was a lot smarter from her experiences that had happened.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, her marriage to Edward Emery sounded disastrous. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, first it started when she was in college. When she was 16 years old, she was engaged. And then out of nowhere, it was dissolved. Now, unfortunately, at that time in Victorian times, when you're engaged, sometimes that means we caught you having sex. Now we need to get a ring on it. And that engagement fell apart. And I think from the stress of that, and at the same time, her mother dying, Florence was really at odds. Her father was a very prominent doctor. He was not happy with this series of events. But after her father had given his blessings that she could perform as an actress, not under her real name, she could perform as Florence Emery, not Florence Farr, she got cast in a show. And it was something like Uncle Dick's Review or some other, you know, tantalizing thing. And she met this ne'er-do-well named Emery. And Emery was a gambler and a ladies' man, and he came from a very well-established family of producers in London. So Florence thought, this is it. I'm going to be an actress. I'm married to this person who also just lost his father, and we're going to commiserate and become theatrical people together. What she didn't realize is that this Emery wanted her to stay home and prepare her supper and wait on him hand and foot. She was not to have a career. She was to be Mrs. Emery. And she started to rebel against this. And then things really got messy when Emery was accused of cheating at cards. Now, there's a lot of things you could do in Victorian London. One of them was not swindle the aristocrats.
Yeah.
He had just swindled the typical working person. That would have been fine. But he got some money from some very titled people, and he was deported to America.
Oh my gosh.
So he sailed off into the sunset, thank goodness. But it took Florence quite a while to divorce him, because it was hard for women to get divorced then. You had to prove they had deserted you for years. And, you know, the whole fact that he defamed her and left her no money, that was nothing. The more important part is that he had deserted her. So she was the sadder but wiser woman from that.
Yeah, but things got better for her from there. So how did she get involved with the Golden Dawn?
Well, from being in this play with the Bedford Park people, she met Yeats, William Butler Yeats, who came to see her play, and this couple named the Mathers. And the Mathers were first starting in 1888, this private collection of people who wanted to study magic. And they recruited Florence to study with them. Now, for somebody who hated studying at college, she flew through the Golden Dawn curriculum. She loved it. She loved studying magic and spells and how to meditate, how to astral travel. And so in no time at all, she was one of the first people to go through all the different orders of study. And she was the one who actually was in charge of initiating people through the second series. And during this time, she was known as a leader, which for a woman in a club, which most clubs didn't allow women to be in charge, was fabulous. And of course, people started falling in love with her. Aleister Crowley, who joined the Golden Dawn, was quite smitten with her, wrote a play based on her, was really trying to seduce her. And he was quite a bit younger than her, but she also was not having it with Aleister Crowley, and eventually led to kicking him out because he was trying to seduce his way through levels 1 and 2. And that was not part of the agenda, but she was large and in charge. And it was a fascinating moment in history for a woman to be in charge in one of the most prominent clubs, private clubs in London.
Oh, that's absolutely incredible. And as you say, you know, so ahead of her time. So, you know, you mentioned that she played the moon goddess Selene in this play. And this is a part that kind of hints at her high priestess status later on. So in what ways did Florence embody the high priestess archetype?
The thing that was amazing about Florence and her paying attention to her tuition is that she really felt in tune with psychic abilities. When she would go to the British Museum, She would meditate to channel outside of this mummy display, and she felt she was having not only a conversation, but a relationship, what was called an adept, a former spirit in this mummy case. And she was saying that this mummy, this adept, was telling her, hey, I'm studying the Golden Dawn curriculum too. And wouldn't you know it, we're at the same level, let's chat. And so she was taking notes about this conversation she was having with this spirit, that it was a handmaiden from Egypt who passed, who was in this mummy sarcophagus, and they were astral traveling together. She made notes on the conversation with Mutant Menu, that was the name of the spirit she was talking with, and she sent them to the Paris office of the Golden Dawn. And Mathers, the person who had introduced her, said, yes, that sounds right. That does sound like she is a spirit. Now, later on, science has proved that they took x-rays and it was in fact not a woman, but a man that was dressed up in women's clothing that was buried in this sarcophagus. So that particular spirit might have been just renting space and talking to Florence. We don't know. But she was very psychic, and she brought the Golden Dawn and their ideas about astral travel and bringing the whole ideas about how you communicate with higher entities in the universe to its highest teaching levels.
That must have been so exciting. And so often, like these days, anybody who talks about this, there's a tendency to like pathologize them, you know, like you can't be having this experience, you're delusional or you're schizophrenic or whatever the case may be. But in the Victorian period, was there more acceptance of psychic activity and astral travel, or was the Golden Dawn kind of an exception?
You know, you're absolutely onto something there, Jessica, because, you know, at that time in the Victorian age, you know, science and magic were both unexplored territories. They were very close. If we can make electricity and it's invisible and telegraphs are sending messages without, you know, having spirits there, then why magically can't you fly? Why can't you communicate with other electrical entities? And so at the time, there was much more credence given to the idea of astral travel or sending energies and communicating with other, you know, ideas of what, who's living in a planet or in the solar system. I think science is still learning some of these ideas. If you've ever been in a group where someone is ill and everybody's sending healing energy at the same time, science has proved that there is a marked difference in the person who's receiving the energy. So there's a lot yet to be scientifically proved. But I think for those of us who have had some experience with the other side, and I don't want to say any more about it, except for it has happened to me enough for me to at least believe that there is another universe traveling in different forms.
Oh yes, I'd agree. Absolutely. And it's sad that it feels like this is something that people don't really feel like they can talk about this anymore, you know, just because of the way that it's kind of portrayed these days, you know, science has kind of taken over and there isn't a lot of room for spirituality.
Absolutely. And I think we have to keep it private and to ourselves because we don't need to be attacked about our experiences.
Yeah. And that's awfully sad, but so interesting to think about this time and how she could study magic and it was fine. And it was wonderful.
Yes.
And of course now we have her legacy and we have reminders of her in these beautiful cards, right?
And you know what was so interesting is that even the pragmatic men at the time, like George Bernard Shaw, who was her lover, accused her of just wasting her talent on mumbo jumbo. He was furious that she wouldn't be in his plays and that she was dedicating her life to the Golden Dawn. And he wrote several plays making fun of her and making fun of the people in her lives that believed in these alternate ideas about what was happening. The relationship with Shaw was very troubled. I mean, let's face it, Shaw was a narcissist, and yet he loved the idea of the new woman. He could have sex with her and not have to promise marriage or live with her. And so this was his idea of, yes, she's a person just like me, and she can see to her needs, and there doesn't need to be any constraints about it, which I'm all in favor of. But there was also this idea, and yet you have to conform to my idea of womanhood.
Yeah, their relationship sounded really toxic. How did she get involved with him?
Well, because he'd seen her at the play, he at that point was not a produced playwright. He was from Dublin. He was writing reviews, music reviews, and he was so talented. I mean, my God, the man, he could talk to the moon and back about anything. He was such an authority. But what happened is he really did not want to keep writing reviews of plays. He wanted to be an established playwright in London. And he could not get it going on until Florence got funding to stage a play. Now, she chose the same terrible playwright who had done the one where she played the goddess and William Butler Yeats on a double bill. And the first night, the double bill got such a terrible reception. We're talking tomatoes thrown. We're talking people stamping their feet and throwing things. And William Butler Yeats, this is his first play. It's called The Land of Heart's Desires. He was crushed. And so what Florence knew was that George Bernard Shaw was working on a play called Arms and the Man. And she telegraphed him and said, "Help, can you please give us this play?" And sure enough, he stepped in. And you have to remember, plays at that time were learned within days because people had been trained from a very young childhood age to memorize things. And so I believe they put this play up in 4 days.
Oh, my God.
People memorize things. Of course, they probably had pieces of paper with, you know, speech number 93 over here. But Arms the Man was produced by the Avenue Theater with Florence Farr being the producer. And it was Shaw's first hit. And without Florence, or George Bernard Shaw and William Butler Yeats would never have had their plays produced for the first time in London. So good for her. She saw her friends and lovers, and Yeats became a lover later on, but she really believed in putting her, or Annie Horniman, who was one of the people who subsidized the Golden Dawn, they put these plays on for these men, which, you know, kudos for them and kudos for the men who benefited from it.
That's incredible. And now, of course, these men are so famous, and a large part of that is because of her.
Absolutely. Yeats won the Nobel Prize in Literature. You know, Shaw became an international literary star. Neither one of them particularly respected Florence's work or supported her work. And so I think that is disheartening to think that women can stand up, produce, champion men's works, and yet it is not reciprocated.
That is so sad. And of course, she also had that relationship with Yeats, which you mentioned. And was that a little healthier than the one?
Absolutely. You know, Yeats was not such a chauvinist. He really believed that women should have equal rights. And Florence was the one who graduated him through the different levels. So she helped him study. She helped him become a very powerful magician within the society. He at one time led it when Florence didn't want to. But he also hired her to be in The Countess Kathleen, the play that he wrote for his first love, Maud Gonne. And they collaborated on this strange form of poetry that was chanted, and Florence would play the harp. And when I say she would play the harp, she would do this weird modern age version of, she would pluck a harp string and get a tone going. And then she would say some words, bing. And then she would say some other words, and people were freaking out. They were going, "What is this?" It was like performance art. But you know, what's so funny about Yeats is he was dyslexic and tone deaf. And yet here he is doing this chanted poetry with Florence in Dublin, in London, in all these different places. And they collaborated beautifully together. In fact, towards the end of his life, Yeats wrote a very touching poem about how Florence was one of the first people to believe in him. And she was such a guiding star to his explorations and to who he was and what his poetry was.
It sounds like he definitely appreciated her a little bit more.
Absolutely. So
she left the Golden Dawn in 1902. So what made her leave, and what did she do after that?
Oh, it was Crazyville, Jessica. You know, the Golden Dawn was going pretty well. I mean, they kicked Alistair out because sexually he was all over the map. But what happened is that this woman and her husband showed up saying that they were teaching Golden Dawn curriculum, and what they were con artists, and they ended up running this school out of a boarding house. They entrapped a lot of young women to come who thought they were marrying the man who said he was this spirit that was going to make them divine, which sounds like a lot of cults actually. Mm-hmm. And the man was actually the woman's wife, a husband rather. And so the two of them eventually were arrested and sent to prison for rape, larceny, all these heinous things. But because they said they were teaching the Golden Dawn, everybody associated with the Golden Dawn, I mean, this was right after Queen Victoria died, the Edwardian era was coming in, and things were getting a lot more conservative. So once you have rape and larceny and all these things associated with the Golden Dawn, the high profile people who belonged, and there were about 300 at the time, like Arthur Conan Doyle and all these other really prominent people in London society, went, we're done. We're gone. We're not going to be there for that. I mean, and there was all sorts of magical wars going on. And Florence said, I'm out. You guys squabble and fight and all this nonsense. I need to do something else with my life. So she left to experiment performing on her own and founding other artistic ventures.
Sure. So you mentioned some magical wars going on. What was happening exactly?
Oh, this was crazy. So in Paris, this Mathers was there, and Florence and he, even though he, you know, said, yes, mutant menu at the museum is a spirit, he and Florence started fighting. And when he wasn't getting his way with her, he said, listen, you've got to agree with me because I'm going to spill the tea. The Golden Dawn was founded on a lie. And you can go after the people who said it was founded on these manuscripts. And she said, what? We founded the Golden Dawn on a lie? And so sure enough, there are the Paris branch and the London branch started going at each other. And then Mathers turned on her and with Crowley said, we are going to destroy the London branch. And so they started casting spells on each other. Mathers got a bunch of peas and he cast names on each one of them for the Golden Dawn, including Florence, and said, I am going to crush you and this pea will become you. And at a certain point, Aleister Crowley ended up in London dressed in disguise. He wore a Scottish kilt and a mask with a dagger. And he went to the headquarters on Blithedale Road, and he was going to take over all the secret magical recipes in the vault. Yeats came out and they had a duel. Some say a bouncer just threw him down the stairs, but still they had a magical duel. You know, horses would supposedly bolt when they saw Aleister Crowley, you know, carriages were catching on fire. There were all these wild accusations of these crazy things that were happening. And at the time they did not want their magical spells out. You know, some of the things that they were saying they were doing in magical spells were, I think there was an instance of the royal carriage going by. And somehow they were able to become invisible and skate along in like this electrical current behind them, like they were skating and following them. So their ideas of astral travel and what they were using for it, they weren't exactly making the world a better place. It was more like they were doing parkour. So they didn't really quite elevate the ideas for people to understand why they were practicing magic.
Now I'm trying to imagine Aleister Crowley thinking that like a kilt and a dagger and a mask is like inconspicuous. This is an idea of a disguise.
Yeah, he was trying to, you know, at that point, Mathers was saying that he was MacGregor and he was, Scottish. So I'm sure he's the one who put him up to, here's my kilt, here's the mask. Here's the dagger. I want you to go over there and, you know, scare them with a Scottish, you know, manifestation. So we're not scared of the Scottish manifestation. Sorry.
No, that just sounds nuts to me. Like go over there dressed as an astronaut. It'll be fine. Like you're just like something that like really stands out, you know, like, oh my goodness, just like the mask or something, just thinking that that is like just totally chill and like a great disguise. It's like, Aleister, we know it's you. Like
exactly.
Oh my gosh, that is so funny. Oh dear. So of course, the other person that you focus on in this book is actress Ellen Terry. Now, her childhood was very different from Florence's. Can you tell us a little bit about her early years and how she came to marry painter George Frederick Watts?
Absolutely. And it's such a fascinating difference because Florence came from a very conservative family. Her father was a famous doctor. Her mother was very conservative. Ellen, on the other hand, was born to strolling players, a couple who had 11 children, and they would tour the provinces in England with their brood. And they, at this time, actors weren't allowed really to even rent apartments, going from place to place. But Ellen was very precocious. And when she was probably 8 or 9, Charles Keating cast her in The Winter's Tale as the young boy's role. And she was phenomenal. She had a beautiful, clear voice. She actually acted, which at that time there was a lot of declamatory style going on where you just park and bark. And she was actually able to impersonate a young boy convincingly to that the critics went crazy. Then the focus came on her family and her sisters, Kate and others actually started getting more work too. But unfortunately at that time, they also became the focus of a sort of sect of London Victorian society of artists and writers and painters that were very preoccupied with the pubescent girl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she became friends, or her family became friends with George Frederick Watts. And at that time, he was a wonderful painter, and she was painting all sorts of things. And she would come over and sit for him for several beautiful paintings that are now famous and in museums. But because she didn't go to a proper school, Watts and his friends pretty much regarded, you know, Ellen and her sister as savages. Even though they read and memorized and understood things, they were not your typical, you know, compliant, silent little Victorian doll children. They had opinions and they were running around. And after a certain period of time, Watts decided he could save her by marrying her. Unfortunately, the time that he started thinking about doing this was 15. Now, at that age, it wasn't unusual for a 15-year-old to get married in London, but she was very naive in terms of the world. And a lot of Watts's benefactresses, women who were also in love with Watts and wealthy and subsidizing him, were absolutely opposed to it. Do not let that hell child into your studio. Do not do it. Do not do it. And he ended up proposing to her. I always laugh, Jessica, because when you read the stuff, they go, oh, come on, she was almost 17. No, let's say she's 16. She's 16 and she's led a life as still a 16-year-old child. He's 30 years older than she is.
Mm-hmm.
So they got married. I'm not sure that they had sex. It's possible that they had sex, or it's possible that he was just so overwhelmed with being in charge with her that he went, oh, what did I do? Although he did have several paintings of her almost nude, at least her breasts are showing. So mm-hmm. he did see her naked body, but the marriage was an absolute disaster. And after, I think, 6 months, he sent her back to her parents, and her parents were absolutely horrified that she didn't make it work.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know if that's her fault. So as you mentioned, of course, he is 30 years older than her at this time. She's only 16 years old. And his paintings of her really emphasize her kind of childlike features. Although she was 16, I actually think she looks a bit younger. And a lot of art and literature at this time, as you mentioned, it fetishized young girls in a way that would give any sane 21st century person the ick, like major, major ick. So how did the relationship impact Ellen, and how was she able to get away from it? Was it just that he was upset that he couldn't kind of civilize her and she was kind of set free, or do you think she had any agency in that?
Well, that's such an interesting thing about Ellen, is that this fairly horrific, controlling relationship happened. And yet in Ellen's autobiography, she talks about how she was introduced to the leaders and the thinkers of the pre-Raphaelite age. So while she was sitting there, she would listen to fantastic conversations. Mm-hmm. And this was the age of Millay and Lewis Carroll and Hans Christian Andersen, and that they did adore young female protagonists. So she was addressed at least sometimes in a respectful way, where she was solicited. But more than that, Ellen looked back at that period of time as a time when she became very aware of the world of art and fantastic art. And so she got some opinions about what that was. Now, when she was sent back home, here she is, she felt like she went to a finishing or training school and got evicted. She still had these ideas about making a difference and how do you become an artist in the world. Now, Watts's condition about letting her go is that he would pay her an allowance as long as she did not get back on the stage. So his idea was, I don't care how successful you were as a child actress, theater is just Smutsville, and I'll pay you money to somehow grow up. I don't care. So she felt like an absolute failure at home, and her parents were not very understanding. And they had, another 10, 11 kids to raise. And it was not a good look for her sisters, who wanted to make good marriages during this time. And after this, Ellen met Goodwin. He was an architect. And of course, he was full of these ideas at the time, too, about how to make art happen in a different way, and the William Morris School of Art and all this. And so they started talking. And pretty soon, Ellen runs away with Goodwin, even though she's still married with Watts. And they have two illegitimate children. So you'd think, okay, nail in the coffin, Ellen Terry will never be respectable again. She's married an older man that didn't work out. She's had children with this architect and they're sequestered in the country, you know, goodbye, any kind of life. Now, Goodwin was not a great husband, or he wasn't even a husband. He was not a great father. He barely provided for them. And he left them in the country while he kept running back to London, trying to get his architecture company started. And while he was gone one day, Ellen was in a horse and carriage during a private country road, and her carriage derailed. And who should come upon her but one of the actors who knew her as a child actor and thought she was a genius. And he said, "Ellen Terry, what are you doing in the middle of nowhere?" And she goes, "I'm starving and I have children." He said, "Come to London. I will make sure you get theater work." So here she does. She comes back to London with Edie, her daughter, and Gordon, her son. Her parents almost acknowledge her, but not really. And for maybe 4 years, she gets hand-to-mouth food. You know, she starts to get other things going around. And she finally gets a divorce from Watts. I mean, thank God, because she's got two children and she's trying to get started. And then she meets another actor and she gets married. And this actor really was very competitive, wanted her to succeed as an actor, was a bit of a drinker, never really bonded with her children, but who cares? She was now respectable because she was married. And she was about 27, 28 years old at the time, an old lady on the stage, but she was at last married and acting on the London stage.
Right. But she also had this this incredible acting career. Like, after she went back to London, what was her career like as an adult?
Her career was fantastic, especially as she got rid of husband number two. What happened when she was almost 29 years old, she auditioned for Sir Henry Irving. He wasn't a sir at the time. He was taking over the Lyceum Theater, and he was actually looking for someone to pair up to be his leading lady. Now, he'd done a couple small things with Ellen, and because her family, as the Strolling Players, and her reputation as a child actor with Keats, who was his absolute idol, he was really intimidated by her pedigree. And so he was thrilled to hire her as his leading lady. And so for the next 27 years, Ellen Terry and Sir Henry Irving became the darlings of the Victorian stage. I think they produced something like 300 productions. They employed over 400 people off and on at the theater. They toured the United States 8 times. They became the standard of what Victorian and Edwardian theater was. And so she finally got to flourish as the leading lady. And I think Oscar Wilde called her Our Lady of the Lyceum, because she was really Henry Irving was smart and he could talk and he was, you know, he could really present, but Ellen Terry was the heart of all the productions because she was spontaneous and she was modern and she didn't speak like a broken, you know, chart. She really brought the things to life. And she soon got rid of the second husband. And then she started a decades long affair with her employer, Sir Henry Irving, which he hid very well because he was married at the time, although separated.
Wow. So Irving was really her longest and probably healthiest romantic relationship. So what was that like?
Well, I think in the beginning, she was treated as an equal. She talks about their opening show, Hamlet. She got almost no rehearsal time. Mm-hmm. And of course, he was Hamlet. So he was rehearsing up a storm and making sure that he was spot on. But because Ellen, like a lot of actors at the time, had performed it before, he just thought, she doesn't need to rehearse. She's fine. Opening night, she was so sure she was a flop, she left before the curtain call and she went home. And it was only when Bram Stoker, who was the company manager at the time, and Henry Irving came over to her flat with the rave reviews, did she know that they were going to be a success. So she, you know, she had some agency with Henry, especially about costumes. You know, the funny thing too, Jessica, is do you know who ended up designing some things for the Lyceum? Goodwin. the father of her children.
Oh my
So,
goodness.
yeah, so she was very forgiving. It was sort of like, I know somebody who's really good, not only with architecture, but could do costumes. And because she knew a lot about art from sitting for Watts, she had very strong opinions about costumes and how things should look. And at that time, actresses especially were in charge of their own costumes. So she learned a lot, maybe even from Florence Farr's tinfoil nightgowns. She knew how to dress herself to her best advantage. And I think the most compelling example of that is the costume that she wore from Macbeth, which she commissioned her costumer, Alice Crowman, to put on these beetle wings that were iridescent in the gaslight at the time. And it caused a sensation on the stage. And that's why Sargent asked to paint her as Lady Macbeth. And today it's on tour with the Tate Museum with the costume, which I'm dying to see.
So her skill with costumes and her experience with the art world really set her apart as an actress in this time where image is everything. And she had enough control over it that she was able to kind of leverage that into helping her career.
Absolutely. It's like Beyonce or Rihanna or these women who know I need a look, I need a brand, and I will hire the best people because I have an absolute empirical sense of living with painters and knowing what affects people. She wasn't just guessing. She had real knowledge about what is an arresting look for the female form at that time. And she invested in it. She paid for it herself.
Wow, that one must have been so amazing. And some of these pictures I've seen of her costumes, I mean, they're gorgeous. She looks like a Pre-Raphaelite goddess. They're just incredible.
And she was still not selling herself as a sexual being necessarily. When you look at her, she's sexy, but I would not say overwhelmingly sexual. There's more of a classical sense of beauty and balance and message behind it, even though it's very alluring. She was not one to show a lot of cleavage. She had a neat small waist, but she was not into trying to be a siren most of the time. She was trying to embody something along the Empress idea about can you get respect? What's the most respectful, powerful look I can pull together? Not necessarily the most music hall, low cut, Moulin Rouge type of, flounce. So she was very determined in what her look and her brand should be.
Yeah, and she does. She has this incredible presence. Like even now, you can see through these pictures, she just radiates charisma. So, in what ways does she embody the archetype of the Empress?
In that the Lyceum Theater was led by, I don't want to say an emperor or, but more like a magician. He was making magic about himself. And that's why Henry Irving is the magician in my first book. But his magic was pretty narcissistic. It was really about him creating a theater where actors were respected, actors could now be knighted. He was the first knight of being an actor. They could rent apartments, they had agency. But he was not a nice man. He was not a warm man. He did not build family or necessarily community. The person who did that at the Lyceum Theater was Ellen Terry. People loved her, and she mentored and set up so many women, not only her daughter with the costume shop and the Pioneer Players troupe that she started, but mothers would practically throw their daughters at her, saying, please take my daughter under her wing. Let her live with her, you. Let her learn something, blah, blah, blah. And she took on so many women and their daughters that she said at one party, please don't introduce me to another woman. Introduce me to a man. I know what he wants, and I can at least negotiate that nicely. because men didn't expect her to bring their careers up the way that women did. Now, Florence did as high priestess. Florence enabled men to make their realizations come through. But Ellen was more about nurturing, even though I'm sure her two children, Edie and Gordon, complained at times that she was a mother to everyone else but them, as is the way that happens. But she was generous, she was insightful. She, at times when nobody knew, would go in a carriage by herself, go down to the docks and distribute money. I mean, talk about easy mark, because she was very sentimental and sympathetic, but she was also very smart, but sentimental to a fault. Hence her last husband, when she was 60 and he was 30 years younger than she was, she thought that he would be a good companion and that she could provide for him. And he did not know, he would not even be known as Mr. Ellen Terry. He was known as husband number four. So that marriage didn't last that long. She met him when she was touring America. But there is a record of the census that after they were divorced, he was still living with her at Small Hive, her estate in the country in England. So generous to a fault to the end.
I thought that was just incredible. Of course, when she was 16, she marries a man 30 years older than she is. But then when she's in her 60s, she marries a man who's 30 years younger. I mean, that's some kind of poetic justice right there.
I love it.
Oh, my goodness. Now, these are such fascinating people. And of course, you bring them to life so beautifully in this book. Now, I don't know how much you want to give away about the plot, but how much of High Priestess and Empress is based on truth?
You know, it's so interesting that you asked that, Jessica, and I so appreciate you asking that because I write this series called the Arcana Oracle in a style called alternate history. Mm-hmm. So I am inspired by the events that have taken place, and I'm a rabid researcher about their lives, but I do not write the truth about what really happened between Pamela and Florence Farr and Ellen Terry, because I'm writing in a magical realism style where I'm really trying to channel the magic that Pamela felt being part of the Golden Dawn. So in High Priestess and Empress, I've tried to go in the slipstream of what it must have been like for Pamela to meet the woman who was first teaching magic with the Golden Dawn. And Florence Farr was one of the first established magicians in this society. And Pamela's experience with Ellen Terry is that Ellen Terry actually did encourage Pamela to live with her. She took her from New York. They sailed over to London. She lived in her house for a while. She tried to set up Pamela's business. So she really was like a fairy godmother empress in introducing her to this entire strata of movers and doers in this empire that was the Lyceum Theater and London society. I mean, Ellen introduced Pamela to, she didn't get to meet royalty, but she did get to go to upper echelon events. And in the book, Ellen falls prey to the bad side of magic. So in some ways, Pamela's experience with magic, which I think was actually true for Pamela, was good and bad. There is a cost to participating in magic, which I try to honor in writing about the Golden Dawn, is that everything costs something. You know, you learn a magic spell, you don't get to have it manifest for free. And so in my book, I follow the power and the positions that both Florence and Ellen have. And what were the gifts that they gave to Pamela to create her tarot deck? And what was the cost in them becoming her muses? Because they both have to pay for it in certain ways. I think it must have been terrifying and wonderfully exhilarating to be a woman in Victorian times, to be worshipped by men and yet defined by them, and then to go at the end of it, oh, forget it. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to marry four times. I'm going to start my own dance troupe. I'm going to produce my own plays. I mean, how both Ellen and Florence had to defy the conventions of the time, I try to follow in my book, that they had to break free of the men who gave them a leg up and yet wouldn't let them in.
And it is such an amazing book. Oh my goodness. I can't recommend it enough. So where can we find more about you and your work?
Oh, thank you, Jessica. You can find me at susanwants.com. In a month, I'm going to be giving a talk for the Yeats Society about Pamela and William Butler Yeats, about how they were very competitive in the Golden Dawn Society, and how there was one particular year, 1903, how they became very close friends. In fact, Yeats at one time said he doesn't trust anybody but Pamela Coleman Smith to make his designs come true. So I'll be speaking to the Yeats Society. Later on, I'm going to be having a book launch in New York City for High Priestess and Empress. You can find out the dates of that on my website. And I'm so excited. This October, I'm going to be talking for Atlantis Bookshop in London, at the Plowman's Bar. And so I have a couple other dates. I'll be at the UK Tarot Convention in October with Avril Price, and I'll have other dates listed on my website.
Well, that's wonderful. We will sure look forward to that. Susan, thank you so much. You've been such an amazing guest.
Once again, I'd like to thank Susan Wands for being our guest today. Her new book is High Priestess and Empress, and it's out on May 14th. I'd also like to thank our superstar patrons on Patreon, Melanie Baker, Michael Beckwith, Bethany Bennett, Andy Christopher, Charlotte Collings, Rachel Cooney, Michelle Dunbar, James Finch, Adriana Herrera, Sean Ingham, Emma Young, Miriam Caceres, Kirsten Lawrence, Scott Lohman, Lizzie Ortmeyer, Shannon Roth, Catherine Rowley Williams, Icy Sedgwick, and Denny White. Thank you all so much. If you would like to support the show by becoming a patron, you can find us on patreon.com/dirtysexyhistory. You can also rate, review, and subscribe, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, and Blue Sky at Dirty Sexy History. We are also on TikTok for as long as that lasts, and we're starting to post reels there and on Instagram as well. So stop by and check it out. As always, our website for longer history articles is dirtysexyhistory.com. Have a great week, guys. See you next time.